Hello and welcome once again to your political discussions here on Radio Verulam 92.6 FM. And today at Radio Verulam, we are once again speaking to local Conservative MP Bim Afolami to get the answers to your questions. And for fairness, and because we want to answer your questions and your issues, we speak to Bim from the Conservatives, we speak to Bambos Charalambos from Labour, and of course we speak to St Albans' own MP Daisy Cooper from the Liberal Democrats to get a fair spread across the major parties. But remember, if you've not been lucky enough to get an answer from Bim this time, he will be back again next month. And to remind you as well, to send your questions in to jason.mckenna@radioverulam.com and we will endeavour to get your questions to the relevant member of parliament or politician that you want asked. But let's move it into the questions. And since we last talked, Bim, there was a lot of furore around Christmas, whether it being on or off. Were you still able to enjoy this slightly different festive period?
Yes, I was, because I had the rare thing of being at home rather than sort of darting off all over the country with lots of presents and suitcases in the car. So to be honest, it was fine. And, you know, little boys who enjoy Christmas at home. So look, for us, it was fine. I do, you know, I have huge sympathy with people who, you know, they couldn't, you know, they didn't have a fun Christmas. They didn't have a good time for various reasons. And so, you know, I'm very, very aware and mindful of that. And that was why, you know, I supported us having it as open as possible. But, you know, it didn't happen. So there we are.
And also on the topic of the country re-entering a total lockdown, I do have to ask, how has this affected your work and your abilities as an MP? How have you been able to help constituents during this time?
The truth is, the constituency work continues as it has, because most constituency work is done with my team in the office. It's calling up government departments, it's writing letters, it's speaking to constituents, and that can happen, to be perfectly frank. Most of it can happen remotely. I think the difficulty is the more political, visible side of being an MP. That's what you can't do. You can't go round about on Fridays opening things. You can't, you know, it's much, much harder to get things raised in the chamber, in the House of Commons, in debates, that sort of thing. It's that that has suffered the most. And I think it's important that people realise that, yes, you know, being an MP is about dealing with the constituents' concerns. But the truth is, we have local, we have district council, we have county council, we have police and crime commissioner, we have parish councils. You know, we actually have a lot of local representation. And quite a lot of the time, as a member of parliament, you are directing people to local institutions like the ones I've just mentioned. Your job in parliament is a national role in Westminster making laws and scrutinising government action, or indeed being part of the government. So I think that it's important that we recognise that that is still the primary function of a member of parliament. And that primary function, I'm sorry to say, has not been working nearly as well as it should have done, though I am hopeful that around, give or take a month or two around the Queen's speech, which is due in May, we will hopefully get back to basically parliament acting as normal.
Things have been very different since, well, December the 31st, because the Brexit deal passed. And I do have to ask, how happy are you with this deal, Bim? Are you proud that the Conservatives were able to pass this? Or do you accept that there are still some teething problems that have to be worked on?
I mean, the truth is, there is no deal in the history of deals between countries that can't be improved in one way or another. This is no different. I am very proud we managed to get a trade deal done in record time. I can remember very, very well people telling me with complete assurance that it would not be possible to do a trade deal in a year. Well, it has been. And also, you know, we have got a framework with which to build on. And so, yeah, you know, let's just get on with it and move forward. In terms of the teething problems you mentioned, the fact is, quite a lot of those things have been problems that have been, how do I put it, deliberately not necessarily fixed in a practical way as quickly as they should have been by certain European countries. And I just hope that we sort of get to a more sensible position, because it makes sense for everybody, for everything to work as smoothly as possible.
Is this what you're alluding to there, part of the red tape affecting British companies? Is the government going to work with companies to kind of alleviate those problems? Because that was one of the big things that people are talking about, maybe switching trade because it just was taking far too much time to get trades done.
Yeah, look, change in whatever direction is always at the beginning, and we're only a month or so in now as we speak. You know, change is always tricky for people involved in it. And I don't minimize that. And when I was a corporate lawyer doing deals in different countries, you know, I saw a lot of different ways of operating. However, the government is helping those who have real problems. I think in the fishing industry, I think the government supported them with something around £25 million, if I'm right. So there were issues, particularly to that industry, that we have now directly supported. And there'll be other things that come up. Ultimately, though, you know, it's a basis on which we can operate. And just to give by way of comparison, anybody who is dealing with the United States, which is our biggest single individual country trade partner, we have no trade agreement with them at all. And yet over the years, we've been able to function pretty well. And you speak to anybody who does things in the United States and they can function fairly well. And there isn't even a trade agreement. So, you know, these things can be worked out pretty sensibly, but they will require the cooperation and the willingness to do so on both sides. And I hope we get there very soon.
Moving it to local issues here, you've talked about local constituents, the effects that students and university has had on them with this COVID lockdown. This month, you said that we need an easier way for students to claim back on their tuition fees and accommodation costs, and that you are actively working on this in government. Can you give an update on what progress has been made?
Well, since I've spoken in the House of Commons, which you quoted from on this, I've been speaking to Number 10 Downing Street, the education advisor, I've spoken to the Secretary of State for Education, the universities minister, and have submitted proposals to them that are being considered. I think the broader point is that there is definitely a need over the long term to simplify the process by which, if your university has not done what it should do by you as a student, then you should have a way of quickly getting money back or recompense in some shape or form. And that should be a standardized, relatively easy process. It should not be as hard as universities have made it over the last few years. In the shorter term, to do with COVID, you know, this is obviously a very particular situation. And it's my view that there should be more universities doing things that some universities have done. For example, with accommodation costs, you know, if you have been banned from going somewhere to stay in it, it is pretty unreasonable to charge you for that term, for example. And by the way, some universities have acted and have, you know, paid students back their money on these things. So it's not like no universities have done so. I just want all universities to have the same approach that the best in class have. And it's worth saying that the best universities, a lot of these things, are not necessarily the most prestigious ones that you can think of. I can think of a constituent. She actually did work experience with me last year. She is at a college at Cambridge, and they've treated her very poorly, very poorly. And you'd have thought a college at Cambridge, you know, they have the opportunity to have a sort of easier pastoral relationship. It's a small unit. And they've been really, really appalling. So it's not that, you know, the top universities are very necessarily very good at dealing with students. And I made the point to them when I've spoken to Cambridge colleges about this, that if they don't change the way they behave, you know, they're not going to be top for very long, because things change and the world moves fast, and you can't rely on the fact that you were founded a very long time ago and sort of old outdated prestige. You know, you've got to act and be a good, you've got to be a good university for undergraduates now.
Keeping the focus on local issues here, Bim, and this month you've been trying to raise awareness of a campaign called Spring Into Health. Is the challenge from the mental health charity Mind to help boost your mental and physical health and help raise money for a really worthwhile cause. The challenge is to cover the distance of the perimeter around Hertfordshire of 170 miles before Friday, the 16th of April, 2021. I do have to ask, Bim, have you been able to take part in this and how many miles have you covered?
I haven't got very far yet, is the very honest answer to that question, but I am planning to. And look, I think the important thing here is that mental well-being and indeed mental health is, I think, going to be one of the biggest problems as we come out of this sort of ghastly period of time. And we need to support the organizations that are helping people go through that. And so there's this initiative, but you know what, there are others that I may or may not be aware of that are doing very similar, very good things. And I just urge people, mental health charities that you're aware of, or indeed simply thinking about people's mental well-being and trying to help people with that. If we can all do that, then I think that the situation will be better for everybody.
Yes, it's a good cause to raise awareness to this. And I suppose just a follow-up question to this is, because you haven't done too many miles now, are you planning to have a Forrest Gump moment where you just run and run and run and then you can complete those 170 miles in like a couple of days or something like that, Bim?
The truth is I do need to find the time to sort of do a lot of miles. I think that's really the point. And at the moment, I haven't found out exactly, because the difficulty with this sort of thing is, of course, where you do it. And you've got to make sure you sort of give yourself the space to do that. But look, I've got time. I am confident I will go at least a decent way towards 170. But next time I come on, you can quiz me on what I've come up with. So I don't have a great plan as of yet.
I look forward to it, Bim. And moving it back.
I don't. But there we are.
You might have one of those Forrest Gump beards. I'm looking forward to seeing you. You know, obviously we do this over Zoom. You'll be there with your sports gear on. You might even be running on the spot when we're talking next. But let's move it back to party politics. And Labour held an opposition day debate and won by a landslide of 278 votes to naught on the issue of cancelling the cut to universal credit. I do have to ask, why did you not vote on this issue? And this was also a listener question from Marco.
I didn't vote on it because it's an opposition day debate that has no legislative force whatsoever. And they are designed in order to put governments in tricky spots. I don't, by the way, think it's illegitimate for Labour to do this. It's what oppositions do. But I also think the Conservative Party was... And I had several chats with the Chief Whip the weekend before and various other people in government and made my view known that I think we should abstain on these things because actually we are making a decision no later than the budget, which takes place in, I don't know, 5 weeks from now. And we're going to make the decision not just in relation to universal credit, but in relation to loads of different things. And that's the right time to do it because the Chancellor is looking at all of those things as a whole, right? The difficulty is if you just decide to take big financial fiscal decisions, this isn't just a few quid, right? We're talking billion. If you decide to do that just because the opposition fancies having an opposition day debate motion or because of what's going on in the media, you're going to make mistakes overall. That just isn't a way of good government. So I think it's a very interesting debate. People have very strong views on it, but the right time to make that decision is at the budget. And you know, very soon we're all going to know what the government's plans are, not just in relation to benefits, but more broadly in relation to supporting work.
Yes, you have actually mentioned the best way for people to get out of poverty is through jobs, but at the moment this is not possible in the pandemic. The Office for Budget Responsibility, OBR, has said that due to COVID, 2.6 million or 7.5% of working age population will probably be unemployed. So what are the government plans then? Will they make sure that people aren't impoverished during this financial crisis? And then if cuts are made, that it will be done and deferred to a later date when people can actually go back to work?
Look, the key issue here is timing. And it's about timing of what's going on with the vaccinations. And indeed, obviously, that's a derivative of what's going on with the pandemic. But also, it's about the timing of how the economy recovers and how quickly and in what sectors and how that is turning into jobs. So really, it's a judgment call around timing. Of course, you're right that it's very, all the job support in the world doesn't work if there are no jobs. At the same time, you've got to make sure you have the measures in place to try and stimulate as much job creation as possible, even if on the current metrics, the economists in places like the Office of Budget Responsibility or the Institute for Fiscal Studies say, well, unemployment's going to remain at X level. Well, why not let's try and deal with that problem? Maybe let's try and incentivize more businesses to start up or to increase the number of jobs they create, et cetera. So what I'm trying to say is there's a whole mixture of stuff that goes into this, but timing is of course key. And that I know is going to be at the center of the Prime Minister, the Chancellor and the Work and Pension Secretary's thinking.
Talking of job stimulation and on the issue of cancelling the cut or doing whatever with universal credit, I do want to ask, do you believe there's a different way of stopping national debt getting out of control? Because you and I are both historians, and an example that I'm giving to you that I gave to Daisy Cooper and that I gave to Bambos Charalambos of Labour is the fact that post-World War II, and again, I know you don't like World War II comparisons, I don't either, but the fact is that post-World War II, Keynesianism economics were incorporated to help Britain recover. That was part of investing in certain industries. My question is, why should balancing the books take precedent over long-term growth for the country?
So look, this is a really fascinating question. At the moment, I'm writing something on this. So let me try and outline my thinking in a way that's sort of comprehensible. So I think that, to deal with the comparison of World War II, because that is obviously one that a lot of people are making. The first point is, we now have a globalized economy. In the aftermath of World War II, frankly, until the 1980s, there were numerous ways in which countries had walls around their economies. So you had capital controls, for example. You couldn't take, say, £1 million out of Britain and dump it in France. There were capital controls between those two countries. I just use that as one example. So you didn't have a globalized economy. That's a major difference in terms of your decisions you make in government policy. The second thing is that in the aftermath of World War II, significant amounts of the world were completely destroyed. This wasn't sort of a business that's been wound down, a pub that, say, has been wound down because it can't open because of COVID. But the building's still there, the owners are still there, people are willing to work for it, it's just that they can't operate. And they're on furlough. And then the moment they come off furlough, people want to go to the pub again in the summer, and then it opens up. You know, the equivalent of that pub was completely blown up after the Second World War. So the recovery you had to put in place required a different sort of investment. It actually required you to do a huge amount of rebuilding that is slow and much more expensive than just necessarily supporting individual income. That's another difference. But the sort of fundamental point you make is, money's quite cheap. Why not borrow a bit more now until things get better? That is perfectly sensible, and I err to that side of the argument. However, there are a couple of things you have to bear in mind. The first is that interest rates are low now, but there is no given that that will remain the case forever. And that time at which it may not remain the case is not within our control because it's a globalized monetary system. You know, there are lots of conditions that may occur that may see there to be a credit crunch. And a credit crunch, by way of explanation, is where banks stop lending money. And in the event that that were to be the case, and the world's central banks were to decide that they did not want to continue printing money affected out of thin air, which is what they've been doing, then the cost of credit would go up. Now, if the cost of credit goes up for businesses, individuals, and governments, it means that a higher percentage of all government revenue, or indeed the individual's revenue or a company's revenue, goes on paying back debt interest. Now, once you get into that situation, if you've borrowed more than you was prudent, then it means you actually then have less money to pay for things like schools, hospitals, and the like. Do you see what I mean? Because the percentage of what you're spending that's going on simply paying back interest goes up. And so that isn't me predicting that's going to happen in the next year or even two or even 5 years, but it's to say that the Chancellor, who is very skilled in these matters, knows that you have to bear that sort of risk in mind. And you know, dare I say it, this is a similar risk that the Labour government in the late 2000s did not sufficiently bear in mind, hence what happened after the financial crisis. So it is a very, very complicated judgment call, and it's not one judgment, it's one that's made iteratively, constantly. And it's one that has to be made partly on an international level. But it is one to say that it is not risk or cost free just to borrow more and more money, even if at the moment debt is cheap. Hopefully that made sense, wasn't too technical.
Well, thank you, Bim, for that insight into your beliefs and thinking behind austerity, management of debt, and management of the country's finances towards COVID, but also post-COVID, making sure that the economy is managed properly. But as I mentioned at the start of this question here, prefacing it by making you aware that I have asked this question to Bambos Charalambos and Daisy Cooper as well, so you can make up your mind, listen to the differing perspectives on debt management and on this issue that may be important over the coming years in terms of Britain's post-COVID recovery. But let's move the discussions onto what the local community wants to know. As always, with these discussions at Radio Verulam, we are here to help the community, and we called for questions for you, Bim. So let's get into what the people of the area want to know. And as always, if you do have questions listening in, you can email in at any time, jason.mckenna@radioverulam.com, and we will try and get your questions to Bim or to the other politicians that you want to talk to. A lot of people have asked on this issue, and Michelle actually asked, I'm worried as the government's new protocol of giving vaccines 12 weeks from the first injection instead of 3 weeks is not backed by science. There is an insistence on vaccinating people as quickly as possible, but what is the point if it is not done safely?
Good question. And in fact, it's one that my wife asked me only last week. And on my wife asking me the question, I went and did a lot of the work on finding out. So I know the answer, thankfully. The basic answer is barely anything of what we're doing, we 100% know is correct. This is a new disease with new vaccines that have been newly developed. So to some degree, this is a very, you know, like so many of these things with COVID, it is a judgment. There is no 100% answer here. Having said that, the judgment made, not just by our regulators and chief medical officer and chief scientific officer, but has done in other countries, is that 12 weeks is a perfectly reasonable time with which to give the second dose. And in fact, recent data coming out of Israel, which is basically, I think we're pretty much country the second best in the world on vaccinations. Israel is number one. Based on what they've done in Israel, where they're far ahead of anyone else in the world, shows that actually 12 weeks is better than a shorter timeframe for giving a second dose. Now, I'm not saying that they knew that to be the case at the time when they made that decision. But the reason why it was a sensible decision was, on balance of probability, they saw that it was unlikely to be less effective. And actually, it's found out to be, on the basis of evidence coming out of Israel, more effective. So I would just say, trust the people who've organized this. Frankly, our vaccinations are going very well so far. These are the same people who've designed that system. And I think their judgment on this is also correct.
Richard has asked, it seems overwhelmingly that Conservative MPs block people who are apparently only asking difficult questions on social media. Can you explain what is happening here, Bim?
Well, look, I can't speak for other MPs, but I can speak for myself. Many people listening will be aware that social media for people in public life, and I say that not just politicians, but that's sportsmen, it's journalists, it's, you know, whoever, musicians, it can be so toxic because a lot of people in the public seem to think it's okay to abuse people on social media. So frankly, in order to make your life just manageable, what a lot of politicians do, and I have blocked some people, though I haven't blocked many because I actually take the view that what someone says on Twitter or Facebook, I mean, it's sort of pretty irrelevant, really, if they're abusive. So I only block the most egregious examples of idiocy. But a lot of other people will say no, they're just not willing to put up with it. And why should they? Why should someone put up with someone being abusive? You know, the person asking the question said, oh, they're asking difficult questions. Well, you know what? Generally speaking, they're being abusive. That's why people are blocked. And I think those people need to look at themselves and go, why do they feel the need to go online and abuse someone because they happen to be in a position of political office? Because all they're doing is, A, they look stupid to the rest of the public who look at them abusing, but also they are deterring good people from going into public life. And as I say, public life, it's not just politicians, it's people in positions of sort of, in public positions. So I frankly think those people being abusive should look at themselves.
Now we are coming to the close, rounding up this interview. And although I like to choose these questions randomly, we put them into a random number generator so that it is totally impartial. When I put these in and order them, I do try and pick something positive to end on. And I think Cheryl has asked quite an open, interesting question for you here that hopefully we can derive a positive answer from here. And Cheryl has asked, her question is to Bim, how do you define your role as an MP? I think it's quite an open question, but I'm sure there's something positive that you can come out of that one.
Yeah, because if I didn't enjoy it, then I wouldn't do it. I mean, look, it is the most fascinating, interesting thing in the world, if you are interested in people, to be dealing with people all the time. I mean, you know, I could talk to you about, you know, fun stuff and going, you know, being in these historic buildings or any of that stuff, and meeting important people from all over the world, etc. That's all fine. Fundamentally, being a member of parliament is about people. It's about other politicians. It's about members of the public. It's about people in positions of authority in all walks of life, from all over the world often. And that, if you love people as I do, there's just nothing more interesting than that. You know, I used to work in the City of London, buying and selling companies and this sort of thing. And I loved it and I earned lots more money. But you didn't get that same variety of people. You didn't get a chance to help people. You didn't get a chance to advocate for people or to speak for them or to just engage with them. And if you do love people, there is no better job in the world. The thing that I've often been surprised by is actually the slightly strange number of politicians who don't really appear to like people very much at all, which strikes me as completely weird. But then there are quite a lot of lawyers and barristers I know who are quite shy. So there is a, you know, there tends to be a weird thing where certain people in politics are almost, don't appear very suited to that aspect of it. And they love dealing with policy or they love dealing with other things. So, but for me, it's about people.
Do you ever regret becoming an MP then, or has it just been a great journey?
I mean, what else could be more interesting? I mean, nothing. It was interesting. So I probably shouldn't say this, but I was speaking to somebody who's a good friend of Tony Blair and David Cameron. And they were saying to me that they'd seen both of them recently. And they just felt that both of them were bored. You know, they just, there was nothing they were doing, despite all the money and houses and all this sort of thing. That there was actually, you know, the thing they loved was politics. And it is a vocation. It's not a career. You know, a career is something you can step in and out of. You retire at 65 and think, thank goodness I've done that. That's a career. Politics is a vocation. It's something that pulls you in. You didn't choose to be a politician per se. It's something that you felt you had to do because of what you wanted to, what your interests were and how you felt you could contribute to the world. So it's such a privilege to be able to do your vocation. Most people never get to do that. The people I find who I know who are closest to politicians in terms of the love of what they do are, and this is a weird combination, it's musicians, actors, and vicars. They are the most similar groups of people to politicians that I know.
Well, that's a good one to end on there, Bim, and I'd just say thank you, as always, for your time. And for those of you who didn't have their question answered this time around, Bim will be returning next month. But thank you very much, Bim.
Thank you.